Well, hi, everyone. Welcome to the very first episode of The Food Professor. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Sylvain Charlebois.
Well, Sylvain, it's a page in the history books. It's our first episode of The Food Professor. You know, quick thanks for being my partner on this. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's a great project, and I think it's a great initiative. And more importantly, you and I have interviewed each other, or we've talked a couple of times. It's always been fun. So I'm really looking forward to this. So thanks for joining me on this.
No, it's great. I mean, when you invited me to do this, to think about this, it came at the right time. I've been thinking about doing a podcast for several years, but I felt you were the right person to lead this project. So thank you for the opportunity, Michael.
Let's just jump right in. Let's start out by, you know, kind of having some fun, a half-baked idea. Let's start out by talking about what at first I thought, and I think many Canadians thought, was good news. You kind of thought it was half-baked, this $252 million for Canadian farmers. Now, first of all, what's the deal with the odd numbers? Why isn't it 250 or 255? What's the 252? It always strikes me as odd, these numbers that aren't even. Like, I don't get that, but whatever. I'm sure there's some logic. But beyond that, you were kind of, yeah, it's good, but you were, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so to speak, but you're kind of underwhelmed. Give us some background about what and how Canadian farmers are supported by our government, and maybe even how that compares and contrasts around the world.
Yeah, it was interesting. That week I was asked to be part of a show live, and I was asked to listen in to the Prime Minister's announcement providing $252 million in support to agriculture, and was asked to provide some feedback in real time. And at the time, so I was a little bit under the pressure. I did actually give the government a B+, and even tweeted the grade, and was criticized for being overly generous. Now, of course, if you focus
now,
on
criticized by, like, who, the industry, farmers?
Yeah, farmers were very disappointed. Obviously, the Canadian Federation of Agriculture really set the bar real high at $2.6 billion. If you remember, Michael, I think a few days before there was a press release sent out by the CFA asking for $2.6 billion, and they got a tenth of that. So I was expecting farmers to be very, very disappointed. But to be honest, I don't know how they came up with the $2.6 billion.
That was going to be my question. Where does that number come from? Like, what's the math that gets into any particular number of that order of magnitude? It must be based on something, right?
Probably it was probably based on internal calculations, but to me it really was unclear. And so the 252 came out, I think it was really about looking at specific issues, and that's why I gave a high grade to the government. They looked at the surplus issue. Producing food for no reason is probably a highly undesirable scenario for most Canadians. We've been hearing stories about euthanized pigs, chickens. We heard about milk being dumped all over the place for right, several weeks. I mean, this is not something that I think Canadians are proud of. And most of the $252 million is to address this specific issue of surpluses.
Okay. And that's nothing new, right? I mean, farmers manage their stock and their herd accordingly. But I guess it's just with this shockwave that's hit the system with so much consumption not happening in food service and restaurants and in other ways shifting to grocery. But it's not entirely shifting, right? So I think of butter, for example. I think I was reading, you know, there's far less butter being consumed, which kind of tells us how much butter is in the food we eat in restaurants, right? So it's a real distortion that everyone's trying to accommodate to, right?
Oh, absolutely. But when you think about a few commodities, the way we consume food is very different. If you think of French fries, for example, 75% of fries are eaten in a restaurant. Well, those places aren't open right now. So there's this huge glut of potatoes, 300 million pounds of potatoes being stored right now. So it's a lot. But if you want to save the country, Michael, you should start eating poutine as soon as possible.
Well, I want to talk about your book about poutine as well. You know, the irony of that is one of the first commodities that I observed and personally experienced that I couldn't get was potatoes. So I it was a sudden rush in potatoes. And of course, the irony is now or a washing potato. So exactly. Yes, I'll take poutine with that as a side dish for everything.
Chicken wings are another one. I mean, of course, chicken wings are consumed while people are watching a hockey game, a football game. Of course, all of these things aren't happening right now. So it's having a huge impact on how we consume food, where we consume food, and what we consume as well. And so those are things that right now people, that shift is being absorbed by farmers. But I've always argued since day one that the weakest link that we have within our agri-food sector is food processing. Food processing hasn't really been supported all that much, and it really has never been recognized at that as that strategic anchor for the entire value chain in Canada. I mean, and we're paying for it, and the first people to pay for that bottleneck are the farmers.
In context, whether it's $252 million or whatever support, have you observed support around the world for agriculture that's different in different countries during the, let's just talk in this frame about the COVID crisis kind of emergency funding? Has there been other funding for the sector in other countries that we can somehow benchmark against?
Actually, it's funny that you ask, because right now our lab is working on a food innovation index, benchmarking Canada's ability to innovate with other countries around the world. And we actually are comparing Canada with 9 other countries around the world, including Japan, Mexico, the United States, Denmark, Holland. And so this report is going to be submitted to ICED in June.
And who's that, ICED? What is that?
It's the Department of Innovation in Ottawa.
And, okay.
It's, I can't remember. It's Innovation Canada, essentially. Mm. And so it's for the government, and it will be released publicly in the fall. So I can't give you exactly what the results are, but I can tell you that we can certainly learn from what's been happening around the world, especially in countries like Denmark and Holland, where space is really not a luxury, for one. So they have to get organized. And secondly, they have to virtually coordinate as much as possible. So farmers are really in cahoots with processors and distributors and so on and so forth. In Canada, there is some work being done across the supply chain, but not as much as what we're seeing right now around the world. And that's why we're seeing these disconnects, I guess, across the value chain.
In my conversations with lots of leaders like yourself, we talk about this thing called the Great Acceleration that's been brought on by the COVID crisis. In other words, trends that were already existing have been accelerated or amplified or somehow magnified. So, you know, when you have a weakness in any system, it's been either exposed or magnified. It sounds like there's a little bit of that going on. It's, our system maybe wasn't as efficient as it could have been, and now we're feeling the pain from that.
That's right. And the pandemic is really unprecedented. I think we've heard that term so many times now.
Yeah, I'm out of adjectives, really. I don't know. I've lost, you know.
Exactly. And a lot of people are arguing, well, we've never seen this before. So, oops, we need to throw away, you know, food and kill animals. But I'm just not sure. It's probably hurting farmers. I mean, emotionally, it must be very draining for farmers to do these kinds of things. But at the end of the day, there are other things you can do. Like, look at milk, for example. There is this technology called UHT, ultra high temperature, that actually could allow us to conserve milk for over a year. It is technology that exists being used in Canada, but it's not being used by or endorsed by the Canadian Dairy Commission. You can actually manufacture biofuels with milk. You can make vodka with milk. You can do all sorts of things with milk. But we haven't been strategic about our commodities all that much. We have our marketing boards. We have our quotas. And if there is an imbalance between supply and demand, dumping is the easy way out, unfortunately.
There was a Senate report last year on the agricultural sector. And I guess if there's any, you know, if there's any upside, so to speak, I'm hard to find the word upside related to the COVID crisis. It does seem to bring under scrutiny some of the whatever prior practices existed. Are they the right way to go? Right now is the time, perhaps, to examine. It sounds like you're doing that great work today.
Yeah, no, exactly. And in that Senate report, I was cited three times about this very problem. And in the fall, we were actually planning to release Dalhousie and Guelph. We were planning to release a supply management 2.0 roadmap for the future to make supply management work better to deal with some of these issues. Unfortunately, because of COVID, we had to delay the release, but we are planning to release that very plan sometimes this fall.
Let's move on talking about research. Good. Let's segue into consumer research. So I think last week you and Dalhousie and your partner Angus Reid released some consumer research insights on how consumers are grocery shopping and other things during the COVID crisis. So you know people can find that. I'll put the link in the show notes. But you know, take us through a couple of the top note observations, but more interestingly, perhaps, is there anything that surprised you about the research? Because it probably wouldn't be a surprise to many of us that, you know, when I go shopping in a grocery store, it's not fun anymore. That's, you know, that's not surprising to anyone, but you helped, of course, put some data to the intuition or to the anecdotes. So take us through a couple of top notes, and is there anything that jumped out at you from the survey?
Yeah, so well, grocery shopping wasn't fun to a few people actually before COVID. 18% of Canadians just wanted to avoid the grocery store at all costs. But that, because of COVID, it went up to 52%. So it doesn't mean that people aren't showing up anymore. It's just people just don't want to be there. And they're exposed to empty shelves, masks, plexiglass, and these are unpleasant things. What we've noticed in our survey with Angus Reid is that we know now that Canadians actually do realize it's a different environment out there. And they actually go in on a mission, I guess. It's not like a trek anymore or a hunt for deals or
not a lot of impulse, right? It's, you know, the old saying, never go to a grocery store hungry. Doesn't matter now. You just want to get in and out, it seems.
It doesn't matter. So you have a list, you adhere to that list, you follow arrows, you're disciplined to death in the grocery store, and people have noticed. And so that's why I think right now grocers are wondering, how are we going to be able to sell anything on impulse moving forward? It's going to be very difficult. And they made a lot of money selling us on impulse by using taste, smells, lighting in a store. People don't realize that we're heavily influenced by artifacts in a grocery store. But how do you do that with COVID? And if people decide to go online, how do you do that in front of a screen?
So, that's a really great point. You know, I've talking to a lot of people around e-commerce, and of course, we've seen tremendous growth in e-commerce and in the grocery sector. But e-commerce has never been great for inspiration or impulse or building the basket or all those things, right? It's very efficient. Nobody beats it in efficiency, but it's not very inspiring. It gets things done. And, you know, troublesome, it's an interesting point you make, because it's great for replenishment, right? Just click, I just want the same things over and over. How, as a brand or as a retailer, do you get people to say, hey, try this new flavor? There's so many, I don't know how many products are launched in grocery stores a year, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah.
You know, so you, not only is it the retailer's challenge, but it's how do I get your attention that there's a new flavor of yogurt that we'd love you to try? Because there's no more food sampling. That was, you know, a highlight of my Costco visits. I'd, you know, go hungry and I'd find some fun stuff. That's gone, right?
No, absolutely. And I know both you and I, we've spoken to leaders in the grocery business over the last few years. And I mean, their one number one metric was all about foot traffic. They just wanted you in that store as often as possible. But that is all changing. And with COVID, I think they're going to have to really think differently about the consumer. I mean, if you just look at the economics of running a grocery store now today compared to just 2 months. Oh, it's 5 to 7% more expensive now.
Yeah, there's not a lot of 5 to 7% on the floor for them to pick up, right? It's not an industry that is inefficient inherently.
It's a high volume, low profit sort of a business. So you're dealing with margins of 1.5% max. So something's got to give. So we are expecting, based on the results we got from our survey, I actually do think that there'll be fewer stores coming out of COVID and perhaps fewer SKUs as well. But here's the thing about e-commerce. I actually think that COVID is going to make the entire food supply chain much more democratic. Everyone will have access to the consumer. Look at Cisco Canada's pivot. They actually decided a couple of weeks ago to sell directly to consumers. Who would have thought that?
I think you said famously, and I love you for it, you know, smoking some good cannabis if you were thinking that was going to happen in the time.
I said that to the president of Cisco Canada. Yeah.
And he started thinking, can I sell retail cannabis?
Exactly. No, you can't.
You can't. Well, you know, and just a quick note. I of course jumped onto that site because I love, you know, I love the industry, and I love. I was shopping on it, and I noticed, you know, the first thing that sold out in the site, chicken wings, like 100 pack of chicken wings sold out. Maybe they just had fewer, but I said, well, that's pretty interesting. You sold out in chicken wings. So, I love your idea of more democratic, and that's not just the big food service multinationals. That's your local farmers. I mean, I just got a case of wine delivered from a winery in Niagara near where I am here in Mississauga, and they just put it on my doorstep, and it was wonderful. So that's democratization, right? Now everybody can play in the game. That may not be their best way or singular way to go to market. Retailers have a vital function too, but it's this. Democratization is an interesting concept.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm hearing it from farmers, from processors, companies like Cisco. I mean, we just ordered cider from a cider place downtown online, and the truck came yesterday. I mean, I actually, even though the grocery store may change, I actually believe that over time, consumers may actually have more choices, not less. And I mean, farmers markets are going virtual. I know of at least 50 different farmers markets in the country that have gone virtual now.
I'm not a big fan of farmers markets. I'm a fan of one. I love what the Bywood Market does in Ottawa by actually certifying real farmers. Other farmer markets I go to, I avoid them because I don't know if it's just a reseller or a farmer. They've muddied the water so much.
I know. It really depends on the regime, of course, and you probably heard of the catastrophe going on in Montreal with the famous Jean Talon market.
Tell me about it. What's going on?
Well, there's that exact problem. I mean, there's all of a sudden people are starting to realize that farmers aren't necessarily the ones selling products to consumers. And of course, there were some issues around finances. And so if you walk into the Jean Talon market right now, half of the stalls are empty, which is really sad because it's an historical place. But I agree with you, Michael. Some farmers markets do mislead the public. My family and I, we've had great experiences in St. Jacobs, which is actually west of Guelph. It's a huge farmers markets, and the Uterites are actually managing the Mennonites are actually managing that farmers market, and it shows. They keep it very simple. It's basic. You know, you're dealing with people who basically produce the food that they're selling to. They're selling you.
Let's move on from that and talk about what's going on in the processing plants across the country. We talked about farmers, and now we've got this pandemic processing plant issue. I think Cargill, great feature article in the Globe and Mail. I think you like that article as well.
Oh, absolutely.
So we don't really need to go into what's going on. Just read that article. It was so well done. But I think it's one of the worst COVID outbreaks singularly in North America. It's worse than sailing on a cruise ship, for goodness sakes.
Yep.
So you know, you've been inside these plants. They're not, you know, they're a tough environment. I've been inside one, and you know, it's not. It is where the business of processing happens. But you know, we've seen many plants on a regular basis that have become COVID hotspots. I'm not sure I've seen that in Europe and other places. Is there something else going on? Is it? Were they ready, or was the culture there, or is it just going to happen because of the nature of the environment? What's your perspective?
Well, we kind of have the food industry we deserve, right? As consumers, we're always looking for cheap deals, good prices, and the beef industry, the industry's architecture is really a mirror image of what we're expecting as consumers. So it's very concentrated. 75% of beef processing is located in that one area in Alberta. There's also Guelph in Ontario with Cargill, a few different places, but it's very concentrated because you need to build economies of scale in order to provide cheap products to the market. Whereas in Europe, I mean, a typical family would spend 15-17% of its budget on food. So it's just a different culture. Whereas in Canada, it's around 9%. COVID actually may change that, by the way, because food inflation rate is going to go up while the general inflation rate could idle. I mean, could actually be close to zero for a while. So
you talked about at the early part of the year, I think, as your forecast came in for 2020, you were talking, I believe, 4%. That was like before pre-COVID, right? It's going to go up about 4%, the price of food, for all kinds of different reasons, right?
Exactly. And our forecast hasn't changed for this year. But watch out for subsequent years, though. I mean, the landscape, I think, is going to change. And so for 2021, we haven't modelized anything yet, but I suspect that our models will tell us that the food inflation will remain high for quite some time. Costs are going up. So the food industry will be immune to what else is going on in the economy, I would think. And so, again, it goes back to my early point about processing. The beef industry, when you look at the entire food supply chain, the weak point is processing. It's controlled by a few organizations. And I don't know if you've ever interacted with Cargill or GBS Canada. They're unique companies, but also very private and to a certain extent obscure. It's not like Maple Leaf, for example, a publicly traded company, accountable.
Very transparent, right? Very transparent.
They have to.
Yeah.
They have to, but not Cargill and GBS, which makes the pandemic or COVID a very difficult environment to maneuver in because, well, you need a company that is responsible, that is accountable towards the community. And that's not exactly what happened with High River. I can tell you right now in Chambly, Quebec, another Cargill plant is dealing with C-19. The Quebec government is much more involved with that case than Alberta government was with the High River case.
And where is, and you've made this point, so I wanted to call it out, where's the CFIA in all this?
Well, I actually made a point about this a long time ago and revisited that point just very recently.
And sorry for listeners who may not know, that's the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, right? If I've got that right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm on the National Scientific Advising Committee for the CFIA. It's unpaid, so I can still say whatever I want. The issue here is risk communication. And I know that C-19 is not necessarily about food safety. There's little risks related to food. And so I get that part. The part I don't understand is that people are still asking questions. And as part of the CFI's mandate is the cleanliness of facilities and protocols. And we are talking about animals being euthanized as well. Well, people are asking me, at least, how are these animals being euthanized? I mean, what kind of protocols are approved by the CFI? In 2003, with Mad Cow, the CFI was out there every single day with Brian Evans. I remember he was very much out there. And with the 2012 XL Foods recall, an investigation I was asked to be part of in 2012, I remember the CFI was very much out there all the time. This time around, we are now at 9 plants being affected by C-19 that had to close. Yeah. People are wondering about shortages. People are wondering about food safety, about inspectors being afraid to go into these facilities. Mm-hmm. Yet, we haven't heard anything from the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. I just don't know why. No, I think the public needs to know more about what's going on.
Well, I think I'd give higher marks to governments who've been, you know, daily press conferences. I think overall, provincial, federal governments have been quite I take a note from you, and I give them a pretty high grade for overall communication. But you're right, there seems to be that gap.
I don't think we should expect like a daily brief from the CFIA. I think it'd be overdoing it, because you do want public health officials to remain out there, very active, providing information, the information that people need to hear. But once in a while, or at least a couple of times, you may want to get out there and tell the public there is no fear. We're under control. We're out there supporting the industry. These are the things that we're seeing right now. They are well over 3,500 federal inspectors out there. 3,500, and barely any Canadians know what they're doing.
It's funny. You and I were talking in a different context about edibles, cannibals, and cannibals. I don't think we've ever talked about that, nor do I think we ever will. Edible cannabis, and how it was still a domain of Health Canada, and it should really transfer over to the CFIA, because that's their purview, right? And they've got you intrigued me on it, because they've got the feet on the ground, right? They've got a large force of people who know how to do food inspection, and they've got the numbers to back it up.
But CFI didn't run for it. I mean, they let Health Canada take over the role. And if you understand Ottawa, I mean, it's a very simple jungle over there. It's you have Treasury, Finance, you have Health, 100 feet of crap, and then you have Ag. And so so the CFIA really would not try to overpower Health Canada when there's a file like cannabis that comes up.
One of the last things I wanted to talk about was gardening.
Yes.
And I think, you know, if we think about the COVID crisis, I said to myself, hey, I always plant a small garden. My father-in-law plants a big garden. It's wonderful. I went to buy him seeds, and because he's stuck, and oh my God, all the seed sites were saying, we've never seen demand like this, and everybody seems to want to be a gardener. That's what I'm hearing anecdotally, and I think you've talked about it. It's just a good time to be a gardener. Now, this volume that's produced in the home from home gardens isn't going to make up for a food shortage or supply of fresh. Maybe that's not what it's intended to do. But what are your thoughts around that? A, what can home gardening do just in terms of a food supply for a northern climate like ours? But just overall, how do you feel about home gardening, and how do you think it could help all of us?
It's funny, because I've been trying to think about one negative thing about gardening. I couldn't find anything. I mean, there are only pluses. I mean, you feel good. It's good for the spirit. You repurpose your land instead of growing grass, which really is, in the grand scheme of things, useless. You can
crop of waste. Yeah, yeah, crop of waste.
Exactly. You can take control over your supply chain. I mean, we've basically taking control over our processing by cooking more at home, by vertically integrating as consumers, i.e. gardening, then of course you amplify that feeling. And so, and of course, a lot of people have felt food insecure for a while over the last few months. And so
for the first time, I think many Canadians had their first glimpse at what food insecurity could look like. Right, an empty shelf, and that's a disconcerting experience, I think, for many. Right, I mean, that's what led to or was driven by this panic buying. I think we're a little past it, but people just got a glimpse of that, eh?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would say, I mean, I've never felt food insecure. I mean, I never was worried, but since the beginning of COVID, I've been doing about 50 to 55 media interviews a week, nonstop.
Yeah, you're hard to get away from, my friend.
I got to tell you. And so this week I'm at about 20 so far since Monday.
Wow.
Things have calmed down a little bit. Mm. But for a while there, Michael, I felt like a therapist. Like it was just, I had producers calling me in confidence saying, Sylvain, are we going to be okay? Just you can tell me. You can tell me off the record.
I like that idea that you were like a therapist, because everyone, and I did a few interviews like this myself. It's just saying, look, the supply chain is strong. There's lots of product. It's just about getting it to the right place at the right time. It's a big shockwave. You know, consumers never, who thinks about the word supply chain prior to COVID. Now everybody knows the words, right? So
yeah.
Do you think, so let's end off this our podcast today, our first one, your assessment of the overall food industry and our ability to, or its ability to feed Canadians during the COVID era, really, because we're in it for a while. You're confident there's lots of food for Canadians, and we might not always have the selection we want at any given time, but we'll be fine.
I had a lot of respect for the food industry going into COVID, and now I have even more respect. I'll be honest, we saw a miracle happening every day since March 13th, really. Mm. They were dealing with Christmas every day. I mean, online, they were dealing with Cyber Monday every day. In the store, they were dealing with December 23rd three times a day for a long time. And they still had things to sell. Like, seriously. And
it wasn't just volume, right? It was suddenly this shift of consumption out of food service into grocery. We talked about that earlier. But that's you can't underestimate that, right? I mean, selling
absolutely
50 not. Kilogram bags of flour to selling 1 kilogram bags of flour. Like, it's just, it's hard to deal with one of those things, let alone two or three all at the same time.
Well, I mean, March 12th, you had consumers walking into a store looking for a quick fix for the next, you know, day or two. Now you're looking at consumers walking into a store looking for food ingredients for the next couple of weeks. I mean, it's just, the dynamic is completely different.
Well, that's going to be the fun part of this podcast is we didn't plan it this way, so to speak, we thought we'd have an interesting podcast just on a day-to-day basis, but now we've got this dramatic acceleration of trends. We've got unpredictable changes in consumer habits, some short-term, some permanent, and then we've got economic uncertainty. I can't imagine a different or better time to start a podcast to help inform Canadians around food and the restaurant food service industry. So that's a wrap for this episode. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. Please, 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 please rate and review. That helps our ratings. Be sure and recommend to a friend or colleague in the retail food service restaurant industry. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Sylvain Charlebois.
Until next time, stay safe.